Thank you. It's a pleasure. It's after spending so much time working on the book, it's a pleasure to be able to talk about it a little bit, and I'd love to just have a discussion and conversation, and share with you a little bit about what I've been working on, and hopefully areas that might be relevant for all of us. And I'm mostly excited to hear about other people's books, so I'm happy to share about mine, but only because I want to hear about the other ones that are coming up. But basically, this book, I did not intend to write another book. My first thing after I finished my previous one that I said to myself was, like, no more books. That's enough. That was too much work, too much. Like, you know, I want to move on to other stuff. And the thing is, I was doing, I had completed a master's degree in clinical bioethics. And most of the papers that I wrote were the previous book. And then I went on to do a doctorate in bioethics and health policy at Loyola in Chicago, where I got to see David a couple times, and it was really just an awesome community and just an awesome place. And so while I was doing it, I started to realize, like, I was doing a lot of writing for that, and started to think to myself, like, it's so much work and so much writing, maybe I should try to focus it all on, like, the same kind of general topics, so that I can, like, at the end have something else that I can, you know, do with it and produce. So that led to, you know, realizing that there was a focus of what I was writing about. I wanted to write, you know, even though it was for my PhD, I was trying to write in a way that was, you know, shavah l'chol nefesh, such that it was readable for anyone, but then the footnotes would have, like, kind of the more scholarly or deeper dives into issues, so that anyone could read it. But if someone wants to pursue more, you know, that's in the footnote. But it's meant to be Jew, non-Jew. It was written for, like I said, non-Jewish, you know, university courses. So it's meant to be for everyone, but I want it to also be that, you know, rabbinic colleagues would find it meaningful as well. And one of the things that I found when I was doing my doctoral work is that in more recent years in the field of bioethics in particular, you might have seen this in the rabbinic world, but it's beyond just with rabbis, that there has been a trend that theologians have become a little bit less interested in, like, the public discourse and what others are doing, and kind of more insular. I'm not talking just about in the Jewish world, just, you know, and secular bioethicists have become less interested in what's happening in religious perspectives. So there has been a distance that's been developing. It used to be that, you know, presidents' commissions and bioethics discussions were very theological, and there was a lot of, clergy involved in them. And there has been a move away from that, unfortunately. I think it's unfortunate. And so I think it's detrimental to each discipline. It's detrimental to the religious world and to the bioethics world. And there was a great footnote that I once saw. It's just like one footnote, but, like, it stuck with me in a tradition article that Rabbi Sacks wrote. It was an article, if you might remember it, called Torah Umada, the Unwritten Chapter. And in that article, Rabbi Sacks, he writes very little bit about, you know, medical ethics, even though I did quote him a lot in this book because I found him very inspiring, and you can apply his work to medical ethics. But he laments there a little bit about how Jewish bioethics, first of all, he says there's really little, too little Jewish writing on ethics in general. And the one area that we find writing on is with medical ethics. And why is it on medical ethics? Because it's about doctor-patient types of stuff, the individual's face. But there's not enough issues relating to kind of how Judaism can address issues of the public domain, so to speak. So, so he feels like Jewish leaders are right a lot about what individuals are struggling with, but not about, like, what society should be thinking about, especially outside of Israel. And he laments that, and he challenged Jewish bioethicists to, like, help us think about what we should be advocating for in more public policy and kind of broader issues, just than, like, what should I do, like, DNR or no DNR for myself, but, like, how should the hospital policies be generated? How should healthcare policy for the whole country be generated? What, you know, like, much broader issues. And I took that as a kind of a challenge. Like, I felt like when I read it, I was like, yeah, he's so right, and this is a problem. And I wanted to focus more on kind of broader societal issues, and also a certain perspective that Dr. Benjamin Friedman had articulated. That, and that's Avidan Friedman's father, many of you know. And he was a very, really important clinical bioethicist and scholar. Unfortunately, he died at age 46. Meis bechatzi yamav, and he was really a quite productive and creative and, you know, on the one hand, traditional, grounded, and on the other hand, thinking, outside of the box a little bit. And he focused, he created an approach that he called ethics of duty. And it was like his argument was that, you know, the Western approach to bioethics focuses on rights and autonomy, and a Jewish approach should focus on one's obligations towards their patients. And I found his approach really inspiring. It's also within Rabbi Sacks's writings. It's not on medical ethics. And there is a line that Rav Asher Weiss says that I also have been very influenced by and thought was very meaningful, which is that the pasuk in Devarim, when it says, Lo sagrua mipnei ish, you know, a judge, a dayan, should not be afraid of, they should render, you know, true justice and not be afraid that someone might be angry and come to kill them because of their judgment. And if just because someone looks scary, you know, if they're guilty, convict them. But, you know, the basic question is like, normally, what about pikuach nefesh? Like, normally in the Torah, if someone says, you know, someone's going to kill you if you do something, usually you say, okay, don't kill me, I won't do it. Like, why? It seems to be an anomaly, that pasuk. Like, lo sagru mipnei ish, but if he's going to kill you, so do the wrong judgment. And Rav Asher Weiss, his explanation, which I just find so meaningful, is that society depends on certain essential professions. There's certain essentials that a society cannot run without it. So if every judge would always be afraid by someone who was, you know, intimidating, how could you have a just society? And so there's certain expectations on whether it's judges, police officers, firefighters, and medical professionals to actually have to risk themselves. And like, there's a sense of obligation. And this obligation sense, you know, I think it's really important. And there's a big debate, by the way, in like philosophical literature, and I came across this in the medical ethics literature, but it's much broader, about, you know, what comes first. Because it's not like we deny that there's such a thing as human rights. You know, we're not saying that obligations are the only thing we care about. We do believe in human rights, you know. But that's human rights, right? The Yetzias Mitzrayim is human rights, and Selam Aleichem. Like, there's such a thing as human rights. We advocate for human rights. The question, though, is when you have rights and obligations, what comes first? What's primary? Because they're often correlative, right? Rights can lead to obligations, or obligations can lead to rights. And there's big debates. There's rights-based theories that they argue, no, it's about human rights. But and I saw this really in Rabbi Sacks's writings, and then I saw this coming up in medical ethics writings that I found more compelling, is that really an obligation-based approach creates a stronger societal framework. Because imagine, just when it comes to healing, if someone has, God forbid, you know, like a heart attack on the street, would they say like, it's my right, someone come save me, I have a right to be saved? Or should we say, who can save this person? It's your obligation to save them. Like, are we obligated to save the person, or is it the person's right to be saved? Once it's an obligation to save them, they now have a right to be saved. But which came first, their right to be saved or the obligation? And what I'm trying to argue and try to push in this, like focus on in this book, is like that obligation sense. Like, where are our obligations, and what kind of society would that create? But I did this, you know, in a different way maybe than others in the field of bioethics, because, you know, I'm also a chaplain. I'm primarily a chaplain. I did a doctorate in bioethics because I felt that it could make me a better advocate and resource in the Jewish community and in my hospital. But like, as a chaplain, like, I'm here as a chaplain, and a chaplain's role is not to tell people what to do or to enforce things or to push certain values. It's to focus on compassion, on, you know, basher husham, being with people, listening, supporting them. So I'm trying to create what I'm calling, and I don't really have a good name for it. I'm happy if any of you can help me coin a phrase, but it's like a compassion-based obligations theory, like that focuses on obligations, but in a compassionate way. Like, I'm not focusing just on what is our duty, but our duty to provide compassion and care for others. So, and that's why I made sure to have the word, you know, care in the, you know, care in the title. So, as a chaplain, as you know, I was, you know, as I say all of this, and I was writing this, it wasn't just like, oh, I'm doing my doctorate, so let me make this into a book because I have to do all this writing anyways. But it was like, what are those issues that I see that come up the most and that are not written about a lot? So, like, in my previous book, my focus was, okay, let me kind of summarize what's out there in a way that, like, there's so much material. Let me make it user friendly, because it's important. These are important issues, life and death issues, and there's a lot of literature, and people can't always research all the literature, especially when these decisions come up. They have to be made quickly. So if I can have like summary chapters, or kind of just what are the main issues to be aware of, I thought that would be of value. And this time, you know, since it was for a doctorate, I have to be able to add something to the conversation. I've had to find, like, what are the issues that come up, but that there's not a lot written about, and that maybe I have something of my own to say on it. Not that I have such like a Baal Mechadesh and I'm such an innovative and unique thinker, but at least something to add to the conversation. In fact, not in the previous book, not only did I not say my own ideas, like, I shied away from it. I was like, I don't want to have any controversy or any kind of like anything undermine it. I just want to say, like, what is the mainstream kind of approach, and then a few other approaches, and like, that's it. But here I was like, well, let me at least talk about things that, like, I can add some new perspective and new ideas and a new twist on. So that was really the focus of where I was going with it. And in that kind of compassion, duty-based approach. So there's a number of examples of things that each chapter, I mean, every single chapter, there's something. In some chapters, it's obvious what I'm trying to say that's new. In some chapters, one chapter, I intentionally hit it. In fact, I first wrote it with my kind of idea in the opening paragraph, and I just said it. And then as I rewrote the drafts, I moved it to the last paragraph, and then I kind of hit it a little bit and hinted to it. Because I was a little nervous about it. So maybe I'll just let you read the book and try to see if you can figure out what it was. But I was just like, this is my most controversial idea, and it's too, I'm just going to hide it a little bit. It's there, but it's not, I'm not going to push it. But other things were more creative. And I'll give you some examples. So one thing that came up a lot during the pandemic, but it's like not just pandemic related, but that I was thinking about a lot in the hospital, was the issue of burnout and the extent of healthcare professionals' responsibilities. In fact, I came across a source just today about it. It's like, shoot, it's just published. This is a part of the problem with publishing. It's like, I want to add this to it now, but I'll tell you in a sec. But because this is a big issue. I mean, there's even like articles that have been written, like, are doctors allowed to take breaks? Like, I saw some Hebrew articles on that topic. Because the extent of healthcare providers' duties halachically is extreme. I mean, there is a tshuva in this book in Rav Zilberstein's Shi'urei Torah LeRofim. He tells an incredible story. He says that that the stipler, someone once came to the stipler with the following shaila. Their question was, this individual has smicha, and he went to medical school. And he says, Rabbi, I can get, there's two jobs that I can get. I can either be, offered a job as a rabbi in a small town far away, you know, where basically my kids won't really have access to Jewish schools, and we're not part of a big community, but I'll be the rabbi for the small community, but really out of in the middle of nowhere. Or I could get a job at this hospital right here in town, right, and we'll be part of the community, and my kids will go to the yeshivas and everything, and it'll be great. But I won't be able to be a rabbi; I'll be the doctor. So he says that the stipler said to him, "You should be a rabbi. Why? Because if you're a doctor, the chiyuvim on a doctor, the level that what's expected of a doctor, he says, you're expected to do everything you can at all costs to save life." And it's hard to justify even ever taking a break. You must always be trying to save life. And to live up to the expectations that halacha has in a doctor is very difficult. So if you go to the small town to be a rabbi, there's not as much expected of you. You know, you'll be a rabbi, you'll help people, and that's good. But you can live up to those expectations. But to be a doctor, you can't live up. And actually, I thought that was a really interesting psak. And I'll tell you why it's relevant. But actually, just today, I was just reading, here, I also have it here. This amazing book, I'm sure you're familiar, Rabbi Natan the Wiederblank's book, Illuminating Jewish Thought. It's so good, so packed full of stuff. So he was writing in there about the whole issue of learning philosophy and the Vilna Gaon's argument with the Rambam, you know, the Vilna Gaon's disagreement with the Rambam's learning philosophy. And then there's a place where it says that in the Vilna Gaon's writings, where it says that he learned every wisdom in the world, you know, astronomy, everything he knew. He learned it through the Torah, somehow through the, you know, but he knew mathematics and everything, or he learned, you know, Bishash, Lo Yom Velo Laila. He knew everything except medicine. It says he refused to learn how to practice medicine. In other words, he learned biology and anatomy, but he refused to learn how to learn medicine. It was the one thing in the world he didn't know how to do. And in the writings of his students, they say the reason was because if he were to learn medicine, he would have been obligated then to save a life if ever anyone was sick. And since his focus in life was learning Torah all day, he wouldn't have been allowed to not save the life. So he would have had to be mevatel Torah study so much. So the point is, I'm just bringing this out to point out, like, the expectations on a doctor, on a healthcare professional in general, are very high in halacha, right? They're so high there because if your job is to save life, how can you ever not be available and never not be saving life? And that's the question. And that became especially a big question during the pandemic when I was witnessing so much burnout and so much exhaustion and so much risking of oneself for others. And the question was really intensifying, like, how much should you risk of yourself? How much should you give of yourself? Is it really possible to always be expected to be available and giving and helping? And I didn't see a lot of really good answers, satisfying answers, because like I'm quoting these sources, there's a lot of these sources that really, really push healthcare professionals halachically, you know, hashkafically from a Jewish perspective, to be doing everything. So I was thinking about it a lot, and I came up with like an approach. I'm not bragging. I didn't make it up. I'll tell you where I got it from. But I applied it to this. And this is what I mean by, like, I try to write in this book my own ideas. It's not that I came up with such a great idea. It's just like trying to apply something new in a way that maybe I hadn't been applied before. And I started realizing, I thought about this when I first heard from actually this idea. I remember where I was sitting actually in Riverdale Jewish Center, one Shabbos afternoon from Rabbi Chaim Rappaport. And he was talking about, you know, his book on Judaism and homosexuality and the whole issue of a man who came to him who was gay and was told by his rabbi that he would have to marry a woman, even though that wasn't his orientation, that's what was expected of him. And that this man then came to Rabbi Rappaport and said, is that true? Am I really required? And Rabbi Rappaport said, no, in this situation, we would apply the principle of chomesh. And there is a concept that, you know, hamavazves al yavazves yoshtami chomesh, that sometimes you can't expect someone to spend more than a fifth of their belongings. It's not just in spending, it's also emotional. In fact, while I was writing, another thing that then jogged my memory of this, made me think of this, was that a book came out during the pandemic, you might have seen this, of the Psukim of Rav David Cohen from Brooklyn, right? The Gvul Yavetz on psychology. I think it's called like Psychology and Halacha or something. It's like a pamphlet. And in there, one of the questions he's asked is a very painful question, but it's about, is it ever justifiable for someone not to honor their parents? And because of the damage that has been done, to emotional damage that they kind of uncover in their seeing their therapist, can they ever just disengage from the relationship? They have a chiyuv of kivud av'im, but is it ever justifiable to pull back and not honor their parents and not engage in the relationship at all? And Rav David Cohen says in that sefer that you can apply the principle of chomesh there, that it could take away out of a person more than a fifth of their emotional well-being in certain situations, right? Case by case, obviously, and we'd rather not go that route, and you could therefore justify that sometimes just withdrawing from the relationship is the more healthy thing. And so I started to realize, like, maybe we should apply this in the medical and healthcare context. And I started sharing this with colleagues and with HR and their leadership here and our staff that, you know, maybe people should be looking at their hours. If someone normally works 50 hours a week, they should never go above 60 hours a week. That's giving more than, like, literally put into numbers. Don't work more than that. That's giving more than the fifth of yourself. Or if they normally take, you know, 14 days of vacation a year, they may not take less than 10 days of vacation. They must have to take at least 10. Otherwise, if less than that, it's giving more than a chomesh. And so trying to apply these ideas to like the healthcare setting, related to this, the whole issue came out, you know, with experimentation and like risk and how much should a person put themselves at risk. I had an experience one day when I was asked to see, there was a COVID patient who was very isolated. He was a Holocaust survivor, and his family his family called me and said, you know, they're not letting us in because he has COVID. It's understandable, but like, he's so lonely. And whenever we're able to call him, the nurse puts on the phone, he just like cries to us, I'm so lonely and help me. And it's killing us. Can you go see him? So I of course I went to see him. This is the beginning of the pandemic. So obviously I'm also like worried for myself. You know, is this smart? But I did it. And I remember when I went in the room, and this is a Holocaust survivor, so keep that in mind. He says to me, like, I'm so thirsty. I haven't drank anything all day. I'm so thirsty. So that's like especially triggering, right, for a survivor. And the nurses didn't come in the room so much at that time, right? Only when they really needed to. But they would sit outside the room and they had glass doors. And I said to her, am I allowed to give him water? She said, oh, yeah, please do. So now obviously he's not wearing a mask or anything. No one's vaccinated. This was right at the very beginning. And so I'm wearing the whole gear, but he's wearing nothing. And he has COVID. And I gave him the water to drink. And he was so thirsty that he like gulped it down and he drank it too fast. So he started coughing and he coughed it all over me. And it was like dripping on me. I could feel it getting into like down my neck. And I was like, oh, I'm like soaking in COVID water now. Like, is this the right thing to be doing? Am I taking myself too far? And then like the clinical trial started and they were asking in staff, like, please, we need people to participate in clinical trials, especially the vaccine trials and like challenge studies. That whole issue came up, which is where different than normal, you know, clinical trials where you just give half participants the actual vaccine, let's say in this case, half a placebo, and then you just have them go live their lives for 6 months. And then you just see who does better, the placebo group or the control group. And then you just wait. And it takes time because they have to live in society and just kind of see what happens. So they said, well, why don't we just actually give them COVID? Like, let's just do it. Let's just do it right away. Like, why should we have to wait it out? And that became a big question. Like, should we do this? So, I was looking for like a good answer in Jewish sources. At that time, like I kind of had to come up with something. So, I came up with an idea that, I had read. There's two stories really that kind of I wrote about that I thought were relevant. I wanted to argue that they could help us with this. Number one was in our auditorium at this hospital. We have who's on the cover of the book now. On the cover of my book is a picture of Dr. Jesse Lazar. There's a huge picture of him in our auditorium, and that's the only reason why I know who he is. I won't tell you what he's called because I'll give away the story. He was a young man from Baltimore in the 1850s, Jewish man. That whole mural is all Jewish contributions to medicine. And he was a researcher. And there, what was happening was during a war in the United States, there was a particular war where 6,000 soldiers died, 5,000 died from yellow fever. And they realized, oh, cool, thanks. And they realized, like, you know, and by the way, we all know that so much technology and innovation happens because of military, for better, for worse. And I was just reading this morning about how self-driving cars were first developed for the army for tanks. So they were funding, the government was funding research. We have to figure out how viruses work. What is a virus? How do people get sick? And they wanted to try to understand this. So there's lots of different theories. Some people thought it was transmitted through clothing, through the air. Jesse Lazar had this theory that there were tiny particles in the air that was being transmitted through bugs, through mosquitoes. And if you look on the cover to the book, I don't have the image up here. I could pull it up, but, it doesn't matter. But if you look, there's a tent behind him, and he's holding some science cups. There's a better word for it. I'm talking too fast, so I didn't think of it. But someone's about to help me. Yeah, petri dish, that type of thing. Exactly. Thank you, David. So what he did was to test his hypothesis, he would take someone who was known to have yellow fever, put them into a tent, and then let a mosquito into the tent with him and wait till the person was bit. Then take that mosquito into the next tent, and the person who's healthy, let them get bit by the mosquito and see if they develop the illness. And if so, they know that it's being transmitted through bugs. And he determined that indeed that was what was happening. And the thing was, there was so much unethical behavior happening in research at that time, such as testing on Native Americans and African Americans and, without their consent, that this was becoming a major concern. And there was a theory at that time called the golden ethics rule to research experimentation, which was that a researcher can only do experiments that they will also do on themselves. They have to include themselves in the tests. So this Dr. Jesse Lazar, we even have a letter he wrote to his wife saying, I've discovered the pathogen. He was credited later with being the first person to discover the virus. This is a Jewish doctor. He's in his 30s. He discovered what a virus is, how they work. He wrote to his wife, I'll be home soon. I discovered this, and it's going to be a big deal. And then he said, okay, last thing I have to do now is just do it to myself, because I have to do it to myself what I would do to others. And he gets bit by the mosquito, gets sick with the illness, and a week later dies. And he became known as the martyr to medicine. In fact, he didn't document exactly everything in the very end, and so actually his bite didn't get included in the study. But his colleagues there all got Congressional Medals of Honor, and the question was, is this justifiable? And as I think about all these questions of risk, how much risk we put ourselves into, this new Megillus Esther came out from Koren of Rav Soloveitchik's commentary, right? Cold from Rav Soloveitchik's writings. And in there, there's a story that I had personally never heard before or seen anywhere else. And I think it's so great that they published this book so that the story could be continued, as you'll see. The story was that one Hoshana Rabbah, there was a Meshumad, a Jew who had left the community and knew what the Jews do in Hoshana Rabbah and how weird we are, right? When we're smashing their revels. And he thought, this is a great chance to get the Jews. So late at night, the night before, he took some icons out of the church and put them in the Aron Kodesh. Then he took some leaders from the government and the city and from the church and waited till they were pounding the Hoshanos. And then he brought them in and he said, look what they're doing. You want to know what they're doing right now? And they said, "Well, what kind of religion is this? What, this is so weird." He said, "Yeah, come." And they stormed in, opened the Aron Kodesh. They see the icons from the church. He says, "They're all smashing our God. They're smashing our icons. This is what they're doing. They're rebelling against us." And they rounded up the whole shul and brought them to jail. And they were going to, try them and kill them. Now, the rabbi of that shul, his name was Ravman ben Ravman. That's all we know about his name, because obviously his father must have died when his mother was pregnant. He wasn't in that minyan. And when he heard about it, he was terrified, because he realized, if I was there, they would have blamed me. I'm the rabbi. But I wasn't there, so they blamed everyone else. So now my whole shul is going to get murdered, and I'm going to live, but I could save their lives. And I'm probably the only one. I could go and I could say, wait, whoa, it wasn't them. I put it there. I'm the rabbi. I'm in charge. Let them go. Take me instead. So Rav Soloveitchik says he asked Rav Shmuel Acharon, who was the rabbi in the community, and he said, this is way too hard of a question. We have to ask the Vilna Gaon, who was still alive at that time. So he said, don't do anything until I ask him. I will come to you. So the next morning, early in the morning, Rav Man comes to Rav Shmuel Acharon's house, and he says, no, I didn't ask the Vilna Gaon yet. So Rav Man says, this doesn't matter. Don't ask him. I realize what to do. So he said, what do you mean? He said, I was pacing in my office all night in my study, and then it hit me. The Torah tells us what to do. It's in Megillus Esther. Kasher avadati avadati. She risked her life for the community, and she was willing to risk her life, and she saved the community. I have to do the same. And so he went straight to the government offices. He said, I'm the rabbi. I'm the rabbi of that synagogue. I did it. It's my fault. None of them knew about this. Take me instead. So they took him. They tortured him until Shavuos. And on Shavuos, they publicly executed him. And the reason Rav Soloveitchik knew the story was because he says, as a child, he visited Vilna on Shavuos, and there was a kelmale that they said every year on Shavuos in Vilna, I guess until the Holocaust. It's lost now. It's one of the things that, in addition to 6 million souls, we lost many menhagim in the Holocaust. And we would have forgotten that story, except Rav Soloveitchik says, when he heard the kelmale, Ravman ben Ravman, he said, who is this Ravman? And they told him the story. And Rav Soloveitchik there then says, this is the halacha of Megillus Esther. The whole purpose of Megillus Esther, Rav Soloveitchik's whole thing is that, the whole purpose of Judaism is halacha. Halacha teaches us philosophy and the whole purpose of everything. So the halacha of the Megillah, the purpose of the Megillah is that one pasuk, kasher avadati avadati, that therefore we should risk ourselves. But it's perhaps risk ourselves for the sake of the community. So I'm not sure we have to risk ourselves, our lives, for individuals, right? But for the community, in general, we might have to. And in fact, after I wrote that, I sent the letter. I sent it as a letter to Rav Asher Weiss, and he actually published it in his book on Corona Tshuvas, and he agreed. He agreed with me, but he added to it. He said that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes that we have a concept in Halacha of Milchemes Mitzvah. Milchemes Mitzvah is also people sacrificing their life for the community. And he said Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach applied that to medical research and said sometimes you can risk yourself for the sake of the community medically. So I felt like there's this value of, yes, for the sake of the community, we can risk ourselves. On the other hand, we have these limits, the Chomesh principle. So there's limits to it. So these are just some examples of areas where, I'm trying to point out, I'm not saying that I came up with these new brilliant ideas. It's just trying to apply ideas in ways that they might not have been applied before to come up with like practical kind of guidelines that are not just based on me and my doctor, which is what most medical ethics is about, but more like societal, kind of like public policy, communal policy, there's some on governmental policy. I tried to argue, not by myself, but I tried to elaborate on you know, the concept that, you know, since we know that healthcare, the duty to provide healthcare in Judaism is not based on Verapo Yerapeh. People, everyone thinks that that's the pasuk, Verapo Yerapeh. That's why we have to, that's Mikan Nitnet Rishus L'Rofo L'Rapos. You know, that's to avoid, you know, whether it's to be allowed to be paid or medical malpractice or injury to hurt someone. But the actual obligation to provide healthcare is based on Hashavas Aveda, right? Just like you have to return someone's lost object, you have to return their life, their health. And so I'm trying to argue that, you know, based on the whole debate about healthcare reform and like, is there a right to healthcare or an obligation for society to provide healthcare for all? Well, if it's based on returning lost objects, like everyone has a right to have their lost objects returned, or the way I'm wording it based on what I said before is, we have an obligation, society has an obligation to return people's lost objects and to everyone, right? And there's maybe some things we can learn from that. Like in the halachas of Hashavas Aveda, if you see like damage, like a flood coming towards your neighbor's field and you can easily put up some kind of prevention, you have to put up the prevention. So like preventative medicine might be included in Hashavas Aveda and like healthcare expectations that like at a governmental level that there's an expectation to provide healthcare for everyone. Now, I'm not trying to get into these like, you know, Republican versus Democrat debates. And once when I gave that as a lecture somewhere and like some people were really mad at me because it sounds like very, you know, it sounds too liberal. It sounded very liberal. But I tried to argue like, I'm not saying how it should be implemented. That, I don't know. You need public policy experts and, you know, I'm just saying that there is an expectation by the Torah that based in or society or the community provide healthcare for all of its, citizens. I'm getting political there too. I didn't mean to say that. You know, all of its people who live there, however you want to say, whether it's citizens or not, but I'm not getting into those debates. I'm just saying that there is an expectation. So if we want to live by Jewish values, we have to contend with those expectations and then figure out how you're going to apply it. Okay. Maybe you want to say it should be based on employer health care, you know, health insurance. Okay. But at least contend with these values that the Torah seems to expect of us to return everyone's lost objects. And that includes their health. So those are just some examples. I'll conclude with just a couple stories that inspired me for this, and then, you know, any questions or discussion I'm happy to discuss. But that's the gist of the book. It's just 9 chapters on these different topics that I tried to healthcare, dealing with cultural competency and families that have a different perspective than the healthcare system that they're working with, conscientious objection. We have, you know, in Los Angeles, by force, I have to deal with this, but it's around the country. You know, we have a lot of people who are experiencing homelessness, especially the hospital I work for is on the border of, you know, Hollywood, West Hollywood and Los Angeles, which is really like where there's a lot of people living on the streets. And obviously they end up in the hospital a lot. And so we end up spending a lot of time trying to care for them in the best way possible and make decisions for patients who are unrepresented. Because when they're very sick, it's one thing if someone can talk for themselves. But if they're sick in the hospital and we don't know anything about them, they don't have any family, we often don't even know their name, but we have to care for them. So that I couldn't find anything in Jewish writings about what's the right way to care for someone who can't speak for themselves, but we want to provide, you know, compassionate and optimal care for them. So I tried to develop an approach to that as well, and a couple of other topics. I was especially inspired by a couple of of older stories that I heard. One was a story that I heard from Rabbi Riskin was that I heard him say it a few times, and it's in his book, and then I added a little bit to it from some other stories that I heard about the Klosenberger Rebbe. You know, when he was in the death marches in the Holocaust, there was one point at which, you know, they were marching and the Nazis had basically guns to the people. And if anyone would fall or not keep up, they would just be shot and killed. And at one point he kind of tripped and he was bleeding and he was hurt. And he grabbed a leaf from a tree and kind of held it onto his leg to stop the bleeding. And he said to himself, if I survive this, I'm gonna dedicate myself to saving life. I'm going to save other people's lives. And he just forced himself to like keep marching. And after the Holocaust, he ends up in Brooklyn, in Beth Moses Hospital. I think that was the hospital in Brooklyn. And they made like a minion. He had a minion in the hospital and the community. And people would come daven there. Rabbi Riskin writes that he was there the first Shabbos. And it was the Shabbos of the Tochacha. And when they had the Aliyah for the Tochacha, which, as we all know, that's normally read very quietly and quickly, they start reading it like that, and the Rebbe starts yelling out, Hecher! Hecher! Louder! Louder! And the Baal Kori ignores him, because who would read the Tochacha out loud? So he says, Ibhok gezocht Hecher! You know, I said louder! And everyone starts crying and hugging each other, and the Baal Kori read it out loud. And everyone's just like in shock. These are all, you know, refugees, survivors. And that Shabbos at Shalashunas, the Rebbe says, you know, everyone's asking me today, what happened during davening? They never had seen anything like that before. The Baal Kori should read the Klolos out loud. So he says, you want to know why I said to do that? He said, because we've already experienced all the Klolos. And I want to Kadosh Baruch Hu to hear. We've done this. Listen, we've experienced the Klolos. We're ready for the Brachos. And therefore, he says to his community, what are we doing here? We're going to Israel. Whoever wants to come, come with me. We're going to Israel. He goes to Israel, goes to Netanya, and his first thing he does there is fulfill his vow when he was in the death march to build a hospital. He builds Laniato Medical Center. And to me, that is such that message is like, this is what it's about. This is how you be a bracha. This is what it means to be a bracha, is healthcare. And to conclude, there was another story that I keep coming back to. And I write about it in the book that I also once heard. I remember I was on a Shabbaton. I also remember a lot of these things. They get seared into your mind, you know. I remember exactly where I was again. I was at the Karlbach Moshav Modi'in, you know, in Israel at a Shabbaton in 1998 when I was in Israel. And the scholar in residence for that Shabbaton was Rabbi Leib Kellerman. And he told the following story. He said, There was once a young woman, a kid, and she had a dream, and so she really tried hard in school, but she struggled, and so she asked her parents to get her tutors because, you know, she had this dream, and, you know, as she got through high school, she was having a hard time sometimes, but she took, you know, she started to feel like she wanted to help people and to be a doctor. So she would, you know, go to, you know, science clubs and volunteer at hospitals. And sometimes when her friends were going to parties, she would be, you know, reading textbooks. And, you know, she got tutors and, you know, she was just dedicated to this dream. And she got into a great college. And in college, you know, she thought it was much harder. And she sometimes was up much later at night. And she sometimes really struggled in her class. But she went to her professor's, you know, office hours. And she was really stayed focused on that dream. And in her biology classes and pre-med classes, you know, at first she really struggled. But she would go to conferences and get tutors and go to study groups. And, you know, she was just focused on this dream. And then she gets into the medical school of her dreams. And she remembers that on the first day, you know, one of her professors at the top medical school in the country says, like, look around. Most people in this room will not be here by the time you finish this medical school. Not everyone's going to make it. This is going to be tough, and it's going to be rigorous, and you're going to have to work hard if you want to survive this program. And she says, you know, I'm up for the challenge. And after a few, you know, months, she's like, wow, this really is hard. She's doing all-nighters and, you know, a few times during breaks, she stays at school to tutors and retake tests and submit papers. And she's focused and she struggles, but she has a dream. And finally she graduates. She graduates really, really close to the top of her class, and she's sent for her first residency. And her first residency is in the emergency room. Her first rotation is in the emergency room, one of the most intense places in an inner city hospital. And she's in the emergency room, and she walks in. You know, she's in the break room, and she's getting ready. She's had her scrubs on, and she's kind of like getting herself ready, puts her badge on. She's like shaking with excitement, anticipation, like, you know, I'm here to finally to do it. And as she walks out, she sees one of her friends from medical school. And he looks like he's just seen a ghost. He's like, it's horrible in there. There's people dying. There's limbs all over the place. I saw someone die. People are so sick. I mean, it's a nightmare. And she looks at him and she says, wait a second. We've been training our whole lives for this. There's people who are sick and suffering and in need, and we can help them. We have the training to help them. That's not a nightmare. That is my dream. And she goes out there and she starts saving lives. And I remember when he told me that story, I was like shaking. And I don't know, it touched me. And I think in many ways today, like where I am in my life and working in a hospital and everything, like a lot of my motivation, I still, like that was 1998. That was a lot of years ago. And I still think about that story. And I still tell the story. And I wrote about it right, you know, in the beginning of the book. Because, like, this is what it means to me, a duty-based approach. It's an approach based on, you know, how we can be of service. How can we be a bracha, like the Klosenberger Rebbe? And there's lots of challenges, like some of those that I've mentioned. But Judaism, on the one hand, encourages us and urges us to live up to the challenge. On the other hand, as I mentioned, there are exceptions. There are exemptions. There is such thing as compassion for oneself and self-care and limits to how far we're expected to go. And I tried my best to articulate that in this book, and hopefully it will be, you know, a challenge to, it will challenge people, and it will also give some new things to think about, and both for Jews and non-Jews and anyone who's interested in these topics. So that's the gist of the book, and I hope people find it meaningful and relevant. And so I can't say how it's been received, certainly, because most people haven't read it, but it was really humbling. I have to just say, like, it was emotional for me that when they told me that I was a finalist for the Sachs Prize. That for me, first of all, to have, you know, recognition from smart people was really humbling and special. And they told me that Lady Sachs was one of the judges, and that she asked them to specifically tell me that her husband would have loved the book, and how much she appreciated it. And for me, it was like so moving. So just from that, like, okay, if no one else likes the book, like, I already feel like, okay, Diana, that was something special. I'll have to see how other people, you know, receive it, because it's just, you know, brand new. So I don't know yet how it's being received, but I appreciate the question. That's a great question. I did discuss this with both the chaplains that I work with here at Cedar Sinai and other chaplains around the country. Part of the blessing, I mean, for me, you know, also speaking strategically as a rabbi, just quick side point, like a lot of times, you know, we do a lot of work. We're a lot of things. We're constantly preparing classes and drushas and things. And like a lot of it is like, I'm trying to strategize. Like if I have to give three classes this week, let's say, why can't I give the same, you know, especially if it's in different places, like I can just use the same material and just use it, but for a little bit different context. And then like, you know, make the core piece more well-rounded, and like you don't have to prepare as much, but your content is actually probably better because it's like, you know, you've spent more time focusing on it. And so like most of the chapters, even though I wrote them initially for classes, I then like presented them as shiurim in my shul, in other shuls, on Zoom and with my colleagues. And so I was able to both like make them deeper Jewishly, and also like start to incorporate stuff I was hearing from other chaplains and ethicists, and it did help a lot. I don't think personally, and not intentionally, that I quoted from any other like religious traditions, like, oh, here's what the Catholics do and here's what the Buddhists do. I wouldn't be against doing that. I just didn't come across anything that like, but I did try to quote from a lot of different, both within Judaism and a lot of different ethical perspectives. So it definitely is enriching to talk to other chaplains and other perspectives, though I'm not sure I quoted from them a lot. That's a good question. Oh, yeah, that's a good question also. Yeah, why Georgetown University Press? So I will say, first of all, I got rejected from a lot of publishers, but I guess that's normal, and I'm fine with it. You know, that's part of life, is getting rejected a lot of times. And my goal, though, was an academic press, because like I was saying, I wanted to produce something that could hopefully have an impact on the broader non-Jewish, you know, bioethics world. So I felt like if I publish with Koren or something, like what bioethicists, what not, who, someone who's not Jewish, how are they going to come across that? It's possible that they would, but it's not as much in their face. And Georgetown, I did have an interest in them because, you know, there's a classic book in the world of bioethics called The Principles of Biomedical Ethics, Bautrump and Childress. They came up with the four principles, you know, the classic four principles of bioethics. And they were from Georgetown. They worked at Georgetown. They were professors at Georgetown. And it's even known in the bioethics literature as the Georgetown Principles. So it is known, Georgetown, as like a leader in bioethics and publishing. And so there was like a prominence to that. They helped me a lot in terms of, you know, their proofreading and editing to especially help me make it fit for an academic audience. And so that was really helpful, you know. So I sent it to like, I'm just sending it to like Yale and Harvard. And, you know, I was just trying, that's what I do with all my, every chapter I, when I, everything when I publish in like journals, I always like, I'll send it to like, you know, New England Journal of Medicine first. And like, okay, I'll get rejected. But first of all, they often send feedback why they're rejecting it, which is great because you get great feedback from professionals. And so like over the time, like you perfect it a little bit, but, that was why Georgetown, just cause I wanted to be able to hit a broader audience. And, they were great with, the editing process, and now they're getting it out to, you know, conferences and, you know, the kind of bioethics world. And so hopefully that will help it to have some impact in that world.